Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to the Hour of the Time with your host here, Doyle Shamley, in Eager, Arizona. I want to thank you for tuning in this evening, and you can thank yourself for the information that you're going to gain and the adventure we're about to embark on, ladies and gentlemen. Now, I want you to take notes heavily during this series. Tonight is the first part of a long series that we're starting. And you need to take notes. And if you're really serious and take us up on the offer and information, to become involved and proactive in a stance to save our constitutional republic, then you'll get more stuff via the mail. Now, if you'd like to contact the Hour of the Time, you may do so by writing Hour of the Time, P.O. Box 940, Eager, spelled E-A-G-A-R, Arizona, 85925. Again, that's Hour of the Time, P.O. Box 940, Eager, Arizona, 85925. The website, hourofthetime.com. That's hourofthetime.com. The studio number, 928-333-2942. And my personal email address is hourofthetime@hotmail.com. That's hourofthetime@hotmail.com. Now, ladies and gentlemen, I want to remind you of our fall conference. You need to go to our website, hourofthetime.com, and click on Conference 2007. It's right across the top, all the main pages. Conference 2007. This is a once-in-a-lifetime gathering. They're held annually, and every year is different. And every year has material that you won't get anywhere else. Nowhere else will you get this amount of expert research and training and study. Nowhere else will you get this type of package with lunches and dinners included, served on site for security reasons and also for convenience, because the classes are long. There's a lot of classes, a lot of courses, a lot of experts teaching, a plethora of categories. You get the camaraderie, if you will, of meeting people of like mind and staying in contact with them. We know that many people have made lifelong friendships and keep in contact since the conferences were first started over a decade ago. So you better consider coming. We are cutting off the slots at 40 seats. That is to allow us to have a high level of interaction. We don't want it to be a mob listening audience that we can't personally interact with on the skills, the research, the training, the speakers, the question and answer periods, the outside exercises in the field, the indoor activities. So 40 people, so you better get your spot, because once that's done, I don't care what you throw at me, you're not coming in. You've got plenty of time. It's not till August to make arrangements at work, travel, etc. for only $400 for an entire week, Monday through Friday, full days, lunches and dinners included, and these are meals that are cooked right there on site, paid attendees have input on the menu all the way through the week. It's cooked fresh, and there is so much food you will not believe it. Plenty. There's also, of course, the general morning snack, so if you want to skip a breakfast per se at your lodging or wherever, that can be done as well, because every morning there's plenty of healthy snacks as well as non-healthy snacks, as in donuts and whatnot. You receive a full binder, a hard three-ring binder, not just a bunch of junk stapled together, for the entire course week as soon as you arrive. That's for you to take home as well. Last year's, by the time we were done, exceeded 300 pages of material. That's for you to take home and share with your loved ones, your communities, your church groups, your youth groups, your militias, what have you. Plus, we provide your notebooks, your blank paper notebooks, pens. It's all inclusive. Just show up. Some people have brought laptops before. That's okay. Some people preferred to enter notes directly that way. Plus, you get speakers that you won't get anywhere else. We have classes on by Master Herbalist David Christopher from the School of Natural Healing, the preeminent school in the world. Because of our special arrangements and our friendship with them, David Christopher himself comes and teaches, and we're going to do field herbals and advanced herbal techniques for home healing, herbs you should store at home, how to store them, how to use them. We're doing some advanced security techniques in the form of locks and security in that form. We're doing field techniques as far as building survival shelters, lashing devices, using them. The advanced marksmanship program, the step above last year's. And you didn't have to attend last year's to attend this year's. Because if you're a paid attendee this year, we have a huge discount on the DVDs from last year's conference for paid attendees of this year. So they can review everything, whether you attended last year or not. You can go over everything and see the skills, professionally edited and produced. We're going to be teaching several shop-type classes, as well as classes on herbs and food storage. Nothing this year is a repeat of last year. And what we do this year won't be repeated next year. Ladies and gentlemen, this is need-to-know information and skills. We have numerous people already paid to attend. So don't forget, 40 people and we stop it. So you better get up to snuff, paid, etc., and enrolled. If you plan on attending, $400 is nothing for an entire week. Some of these speakers for a two-hour engagement alone will garner you a $45 to $50 entrance fee with no meals, no notebooks, no nothing. And here we bring them to you, as well as Michael Cremo, of Forbidden Archaeology fame. And these include presentations and video on PowerPoint. And, just like last year, all the speakers' presentations, their actual presentations, will be given to every attendee on CD. Their PowerPoints, their charts or spreadsheets. So it's an immense amount of material, skills, logistics, etc., you won't get this price or these skills anywhere else for a week. Think about it. So I suggest you look on the conference web page, conference 2007 of our website, hourofthetime.com, and get ready to attend. Now, before we kick off tonight's show, I want to remind everybody you need to take notes. And several of you also I want to remind you are behind this month on your continuing contributions. Now, I know a lot of you will get them to me, but this is just a friendly reminder that we are getting towards the end of the month. 9 days left or so is it. Now, we are listener-supported, ladies and gentlemen, and the way you can support the Hour of the Time is by going to our website, hourofthetime.com, and then going to the Hot Shop, or the Hot Shopping Cart, and look at the thousands of broadcasts and DVDs and products that we have available. We don't just throw out spurious items for the heck of it just to fill up the shopping cart. We don't need to because we have thousands of items, literally, that are more than worthwhile. Your donation for those items or outright donations to cover airtime, etc., is how we stay on the air and expand our reach. This is a 24/7, 365 operation, ladies and gentlemen. And we don't do corporate commercials, sponsors that are going to gag us, argue about how we do their ad, tell us what we can say and can't say, or sell products that are junk, or overpriced gold and silver coins, or miracle cures that haven't ever been tested. We don't do that. We're listener-supported, ladies and gentlemen. We know that there is enough of you out there of concerned Americans, concerned people around the world, to keep a legitimate operation going. But we need to expand our reach, so keep that in mind. Now, I'm going to give you a musical break here so I can freshen my throat. I've been a little under the weather lately. And I've been having to really down the herbal tea and the lemon water, etc., to keep going. So there'll be a lot of musical breaks, actually. And this first one is also so you have time to go get some paper, something to write with. You need to take notes, ladies and gentlemen. This is important information. This is need-to-know, no BS info that you're going to need in the coming times. All right, ladies and gentlemen, again, you're listening to the Hour of the Time here with your host, Doyle Shamley, in Eager, Arizona. My personal email, hourofthetime@hotmail.com. Studio number 928-333-2942. Our website, hourofthetime.com. Now, I guess you could call this series the Minuteman series, and it's need-to-know information. And information that you need to share with people that you know you can intimately trust. Because those times are coming, ladies and gentlemen, when you need to have a band of people around you that you know that you can trust through thick and thin, whether that be 3 of you or 300 of you in your area. We're going to start out with a little history first, though. A people armed and numerous The discontent smoldering in the American colonies under British rule flared into open hostilities on April 19, 1775. On a stretch of country road outside Boston, a prolonged skirmish between 3,500 colonial militiamen and 1,700 of His Majesty's Redcoats opened the American Revolution. The initial fighting in the war was a local action between Britain and her reluctant colony of Massachusetts. The government had clamped down in reaction to the colony's resistance to the mother country's economic policies. For a year, a British army under General Thomas Gage had occupied Boston. Pressed by the ministry in London to quell rebellion by arresting the rabble-rousers Samuel Adams and John Hancock, Gage chose instead to take what he thought was a less inflammatory step of confiscating the Patriots' arms supply in Concord. Does that not mimic current times, ladies and gentlemen? But incompetence and miscalculation doomed what he meant to be a limited routine operation. Gage, as in General Thomas Gage, depended on secrecy to seize the arms before the people of Concord could resist. But Boston knew of the operation before his troops left. And the arms at Concord were soon hidden. Couriers Paul Revere and William Dawes notified Adams and Hancock in Lexington that the British were on their way. Mix-ups delayed the British departure for hours, giving the colonists more time to prepare. Find the local militia and Minutemen were not the contemptible and disciplined mob Gage took them to be. They had trained for months and had well-rehearsed plans for immediate reaction to a British incursion, or in modern times we could call an enemy incursion. Gage gave command of the British troops to Lieutenant Colonel Francis Smith, a ponderous, tactically unimaginative officer who slowed an already delayed operation. By the time Smith's advance troops under Major John Pitcairn arrived in Lexington, it was dawn, and Captain John Parker and his militia lined up on Lexington Common. Because he had only 77 men, Parker had no thought of impeding the 700 British soldiers. He wanted to make a display of patriot resolve. But as the militiamen slowly obeyed Pitcairn's order to disperse, a shot was fired. It is not clear from which side, and the green British soldiers, ignoring orders to stop, began firing at will at the fleeing Americans. When Major John Pitcairn and Smith regained control, 8 Americans lay dead. As the British troops continued down the road to Concord, news of the shooting spread to neighboring communities. And militiamen flocked to the British line of march between Boston and Concord. At Concord, British soldiers began searching house to house for arms. Smith sent 7 companies across the North Bridge to seize the supplies hidden at Colonel James Barrett's farm. The militiamen, who had fallen back, and I can't ever say this, but to Punk and to Set Hill, advanced on the 3 companies left to guard the bridge. And as the militia approached, they saw the smoke of burning military supplies rising from town. Fearing that their homes were being put to the torch, they set out to save them. After the British withdrew across the bridge, the Colonials continued to advance until the British fired a volley. Major Buttrick of Concord then gave the order, "Fire, fellow soldiers, for God's sakes, fire." And for the first time, Americans fired a volley into the ranks of British soldiers. The British, outnumbered 4-1 and with half of their officers wounded, retreated to the center of town. The troops returning from Barrett's farm were allowed to march by unharassed. After pausing about 2 hours to regroup and feed his troops, Smith began to march to Boston. Flankers moved along the mile-long ridge on the left that separated the column from the Colonials. At Miriam's Corner, where the ridge ended, the flankers had to be drawn in to cross the narrow bridge, and the militia, reinforced by companies from towns to the north, gathered near the road, taking cover where they could. Here began, ladies and gentlemen, the running skirmish which continued to Boston. The British, or enemy forces, encountered heavy, unrelenting fire from the hundreds of militiamen behind building, wall, and tree. But the range was too great for the muskets to do much damage, and the British escaped with relatively few injuries. Having attacked a British column, the Americans had committed themselves. From this point on, the British ranks had to run a gauntlet of colonial fire. Already there seemed to be a musket behind every tree, and fresh militiamen were pouring in from towns like Reading, Salem, and Lexington. Luckily for the British, the Americans were far enough from the road most of the day that few of the thousands of bullets fired found their mark. When the flanking parties could operate, most of the militiamen were driven out of range. But British soldiers fell steadily at every hill or curve where the Americans had position. After the column had passed one spot, the militiamen would cut across country because they had advanced reconnaissance, ladies and gentlemen, and knew the territory, and be ready for them farther up the road. Exhausted and near panic, the British troops staggered into Lexington at about 2:30. Where they were met with over 1,000 reinforcements under Lord Percy. Under cover of artillery, the British rested briefly before starting the final retreat to Boston. Percy knew that his troops were in danger of annihilation unless they kept moving. The worst fighting occurred on the road into Minutomi, now Arlington, where over 5,000 men were involved and both sides lost more men than in any other fighting along the road. After escaping Minutomi, or Arlington, Percy had to use cannon several times to scatter the Americans concentrated at his rear. That was probably the edge that allowed him to make it across Charleston Neck after nightfall to the safety of Bunker Hill, where he was protected by the guns of HMS Somerset in Boston Harbor. However, he had lost 73 dead, 174 wounded, 26 missing. And now let's compare some numbers. The American losses were 49 dead, 40 wounded, and only 5 missing. Soon after, Boston was under siege, and Gage was reduced from governor to a general of forces occupying only one city. The performance of the militia that day convinced Percy that his rebellion ran deeper than he or the ministry had suspected. The Americans were indeed prepared to fight for their rights. To British soldiers trained in formal European warfare, the militia's tactics were cowardly and undisciplined. But British General Percy recognized that their irregular attacks were carried out with perseverance and resolution. The militia's preference for individual firing from behind cover nullified the British tactic of close-range volleys at opposing ranks, followed by a bayonet charge. And what was the final result, ladies and gentlemen, after that and years of struggle? Our Declaration of Independence. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to the Hour of the Time here with your host, Doyle Shamley, in Eager, Arizona. And I hope you're taking notes, ladies and gentlemen. This is just the first part of a long series of broadcasts. Now, this next piece I want to read for you is from a magazine that I have, Popular Mechanics, October 1942. Now, I have the original magazine. So if there was some kind of historical interest in it, and I got the emails at hourofthetime@hotmail.com, myself and Rob Houghton, the co-host, would be more than glad to post the pictures and articles for this piece on the website. Minutemen of 1942, Popular Mechanics, October 1942. If the Japs should ever try to raid our Pacific coast, they would find the West just as wild as they used to be. Hoo-ah. Cowpunchers, hard rock miners, farmers, Even businessmen and factory workers have oiled their rifles and are keeping them handy. Good hunters make good snipers. And crack shooting is a tradition in the West. Right after America entered the war, a spontaneous movement to put their rifles in good shape swept the Western population. Armed men began to band together in many communities. Now efforts are being made to organize the groups into official home guard units. Occasionally, one of the guerrilla outfits holds a practice maneuver on a weekend. Possibly, they will infiltrate the hills that command a stretch of major highway. But the chances are, you won't see a man unless you are a member of the group. Dressed in old clothes and armed with a variety of old and new guns of assorted calibers, they will be taking advantage of every bush and contour to get to their positions. Each has killed his share of big game and knows how to remain hidden. Each knows his gun intimately and just where to place his shots. He knows, too, that modern smokeless powder won't give his position away. Even after dark, his gun makes only a tiny flash. In hilly country, his shots echo back and forth in a confusing manner. It would take a lucky shot to wipe him out, while he can aim and fire at will. Half a dozen men in ambush could account for scores of enemy soldiers. After he has settled down, where he has a good view of the road, he lays out his water bottle and cartridges and gets ready for business. First, he makes a careful estimate of the range to turn his first sighting shot into a hit. Next, he makes certain that he is invisible both from the target area and from above. If he doesn't have all the camouflage he wants, he may even put on an improvised cardboard mask, modeled dull brown and green to blend with the background to hide the whiteness of his face. Most of the guerrillas would operate on foot in an emergency. Some groups are mounted on horses, others have motorcycles. How valuable are such irregulars? The Army has thousands of men on the West Coast, but these soldiers have to be concentrated in the main defense areas. The guerrillas are everywhere, anywhere they happen to live. They can operate alone or in groups. They don't need maps. They have camped out enough and hiked enough to know how to take care of themselves. No matter where enemy paratroops might try to land, expert riflemen would try to kill them in the air. No matter where a beach landing might be attempted, snipers would be picking off some of the troops while others spread the alarm. The Russian irregulars have been a constant irritation to Hitler's troops, and the British home guardsmen expect to fight from behind every stone wall if their island is invaded. The modern American Minutemen, too, will fight a delaying action until reinforced. If not badly outnumbered, they expect to win any skirmish, even against armored forces. That's where the miners come in. Powder men who have been using dynamite for years. Some of them so expert that they can, quote, split kindling wood and stack it by the door with half a stick, end quote, have been studying ways to use their explosives. Tanks and armored cars can be stopped with a few sticks of dynamite, rightly used. Some super high-velocity hunting rifles will penetrate the armor of light tanks and smash the motors of other vehicles. In Washington State, a newly organized state home guard is uniformed and to some extent is armed with bayoneted rifles. The group is drilling under Army supervision and will operate on a guerrilla basis instead of a mass force in time of need. Armed men in many Oregon communities have held organization meetings 1,000 armed citizens have been rallied at the small town of Tillamook alone. In California, the call has gone out, and there is an army of snipers 100,000 strong. Men between 16 and 65 are wanted, and those who haven't done much shooting will be trained in sniper's tricks by experienced sharpshooters. There are more than 250,000 licensed hunters in the state of California, and practically all of them have their own weapons. The present plan calls for authorizing these men to use their arms by swearing them in as deputies, sheriffs. Two examples illustrate the organizations that have been formed. Ed Lucas, a California shipbuilding employee, is rounding up the motorcycle riders in the plant for guerrilla service. Eugene Biscanuez, sheriff of Los Angeles County, has expanded his mounted posse to 350 men, consisting of small bands of rough riding horsemen with headquarters in their own communities. The Calabasas auxiliary of this outfit, for instance, consists of 30 trained cowpunchers who are accustomed to working cattle in rough country. Their horses must stand the blast of a 30-30 from the saddle, and the men practice their marksmanship by shooting at running coyotes. They have added first aid, handling of incendiaries, and sniping tricks to their training. It's hard to find a revolver or rifle for sale in the West today. Practically everything available has been bought up. Standard calibers of ammunition are just as scarce. Few shells will be wasted on game this fall, now that it's open season on Jap invaders, though the cartridge situation isn't as bad as it might be because hunters are learning how to reload used shells. Not everyone knows that used rifle shells can be reloaded and reused 10 or 20 times or more, at much less expense than the cost of new shells. Many hunters reload them by hand, buying jacketed bullets or pouring their own bullets from a mold. Primers cost 40 cents a hundred. Powder must be weighed on an accurate balance. A loading tool that recaps the shell, seats the bullet in the neck, and reshapes the neck to size costs $5.50 and up. It costs $2 to $5 per hundred to reload 30-06 shells, depending on type of bullet and size of powder charge, as compared to $11 per hundred for new cartridges. If you have an old rifle, look it over carefully before you shoot it. Give it a thorough cleaning and oiling. If the action is slow and gummy, take it to a capable gunsmith. Inspect the bore for stoppages and be sure you can see all the rifling inside. It's never safe to shoot a gun that doesn't look perfect inside. If you have a stock of old shells, wipe them off with a rag. Don't use them if their necks have splits. Now remember, ladies and gentlemen, I want to point out a few things. They called the Americans defending their country guerrillas. And that term would be quite apropos based on the tactics used. Guerrillas in this sense are not a bad word because they're defending their constitution and freedoms. Now in the article, there's several other things to point out. There's many photos, which again, like I say, if there's enough interest in it from the audience, emailing me at hourofthetime@hotmail.com, we can scan the article and the cover of this issue and put it on the website. Again, it's Popular Mechanics, October 1942. But I want you to note how the sheriffs organized trained posses in guerrilla warfare and had mounted posses ready to be deputized. There's also photos in the article, ladies and gentlemen, of motorcycle clubs trained and prepared to fight as a guerrilla unit. Multiple guerrilla units. Remember that, ladies and gentlemen. And don't forget to take notes. Ladies and gentlemen, again, your host here, Doyle Shamley in Eager, Arizona. And I want you to consider what you've heard this evening from the past, your very brief history lesson. And let's look back to what this is all about. Probably one of the greatest documents that mankind has ever gathered together to write. Aside from the Bible, but as far as governments are concerned, the greatest ever conceived.
The supreme law of the land, the living Constitution of the United States.
We, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America.
The first three articles of the Constitution provide for the three branches of the federal government: legislative, executive, and judicial. Article 1. All legislative powers herein granted shall be vested in the Congress of the United States, which shall consist of a Senate and House of Representatives.
The House of Representatives shall be composed of members chosen every second year by the people of the several states.
No person shall be a representative who shall not have attained to the age of 25 years and been 7 years a citizen of the United States, and who shall not, when elected, be an inhabitant of that state in which he shall be chosen.
Representatives shall be apportioned among the several states which may be included within this union, according to their respective numbers.
When vacancies happen in the representation from any state, the executive authority thereof shall issue writs of election to fill such vacancies.
The House of Representatives shall choose their speaker and other officers, and shall have the sole power of impeachment.
The Senate of the United States shall be composed of two senators from each state, chosen for 6 years, and each senator shall have one vote.
No person shall be a senator who shall not have attained to the age of 30 years, and been 9 years a citizen of the United States, and who shall not, when elected, be an inhabitant of that state for which he shall be chosen.
The Vice President of the United States shall be President of the Senate, but shall have no vote unless they be equally divided. The Senate shall choose their other officers, and also a President pro tempore, in the absence of the Vice President, or when he shall exercise the office of President of the United States.
The Senate shall have the sole power to try all impeachments. When sitting for that purpose, they shall be on oath or affirmation. When the President of the United States is tried, the Chief Justice shall preside. And no person shall be convicted without the concurrence of two-thirds of the members present.
Judgment in cases of impeachment shall not extend further than to removal from office and disqualification to hold and enjoy any office of honor, trust, or profit under the United States. But the party convicted shall nevertheless be liable and subject to indictment, trial, judgment, and punishment according to law.
The times, places, and manner of holding elections for senators and representatives shall be prescribed in each state by the legislature thereof. But the Congress may at any time, by law, make or alter such regulations, except as to the places of choosing senators.
Each house shall be the judge of the elections, returns, and qualifications of its own members.
Each house may determine the rules of its proceedings, punish its members for disorderly behavior, and with the concurrence of two-thirds, expel a member.
Each house shall keep a journal of its proceedings, and
from time to time publish the same, excepting such parts as may, in their judgment, require secrecy. And the yeas and nays of the members of either house on any question shall, at the desire of one-fifth of those present, be entered on the journal.
Neither house, during the session of Congress, shall, without the consent of the other, adjourn for more than 3 days, nor to any other place than that in which the two houses shall be sitting.
The senators and representatives shall receive a compensation for their services, to be ascertained by law and paid out of the Treasury of the United States. They shall, in all cases, except treason, felony, and breach of the peace, be privileged from arrest during their attendance at the session of their respective houses, and in going to and returning from the same. And for any speech or debate in either house, they shall not be questioned in any other place.
All bills for raising revenue shall originate in the House of Representatives.
But the Senate may propose or concur with amendments as on other bills.
Every bill which shall have passed the House of Representatives and the Senate shall, before it become a law, be presented to the President of the United States.
If he approve, he shall sign it. But if not, he shall return it with his objections to that house in which it shall have originated, who shall enter the objections on their journal and proceed to reconsider it.
If after such reconsideration, two-thirds of that house shall agree to pass the bill, it shall be sent, together with the objections, to the other house, by which it shall likewise be reconsidered. And if approved by two-thirds of that house, it shall become a law.
But in all such cases, the names of the persons voting for and against the bill shall be entered on the journal of each house, respectively.
If any bill shall not be returned by the President within 10 days, Sundays excepted, it shall be a law, in like manner as if he had signed it, unless the Congress by their adjournment prevent its return, in which case it shall not be a law.
Article 1 of the Constitution concludes with three significant sections. The first of these sets forth the powers of Congress and is the basis of most federal legislation.
The Congress shall have power to lay and collect taxes, duties, imposts, and excises.
To pay the debts and provide for the common defense and general welfare of the United States. But all duties, imposts, and excises shall be uniform throughout the United States.
To borrow money on the credit of the United States. To regulate commerce with foreign nations and among the several states and with the Indian tribes.
To establish a uniform rule of naturalization and uniform laws on the subject of bankruptcies throughout the United States.
To coin money, regulate the value thereof, and of foreign coin, and fix the standards of weights and measures. To provide for the punishment of counterfeiting the securities and current coin of the United States.
To establish post offices and post roads. Promote the progress of science and useful art by securing for limited time to authors and inventors the exclusive right to their respective writings and discoveries.
To constitute tribunals inferior to the Supreme Court. To define and punish piracies and felonies committed on the high seas and offenses against the law of nations.
To declare war. To raise and support armies. But no appropriation of money to that use shall be for a longer term than 2 years. To provide and maintain a navy. To make rules for the government and regulation of the land and naval forces.
To provide for calling forth the militia to execute the laws of the Union, suppress insurrections, and repel invasions. To provide for organizing, arming, and disciplining the militia. And for governing such part of them as may be employed in the service of the United States. Reserving to the states, respectively, the appointment of the officers and the authority of training the militia according to the discipline prescribed by Congress.
To exercise exclusive legislation over such districts as may become the seat of the government of the United States, and to exercise like authority over all places purchased by the consent of the legislature of the state in which the same shall be, for the erection of forts and other needful buildings.
And to make all laws which shall be necessary and proper for carrying into execution the foregoing powers, and all other powers vested by this Constitution in the government of the United States, or in any department or officer thereof.
Having granted these powers to the federal government, the Constitution next imposes limitations to protect certain fundamental rights of the people.
The privilege of the right of habeas corpus shall not be suspended, unless, when in cases of rebellion or invasion, the public safety may require it.
No bill of attainder or ex post facto law shall be passed.
No capitation or other direct tax shall be laid unless in proportion to the census.
No tax or duty shall be laid on articles exported from any state.
No preference shall be given by any regulation of commerce or revenue to the ports of one state over those of another. Nor shall vessels bound to or from one state be obliged to enter, clear, or pay duties in another.
No money shall be drawn from the treasury, but in consequence of appropriations made by law. And a regular statement and account of the receipts and expenditures of all public money shall be published from time to time.
No title of nobility shall be granted by the United States. And no person holding any office of profit or trust under them shall, without the consent of the Congress, accept any present, emolument, office, or title of any kind whatsoever from any king, prince, or foreign state.
The last section imposes limitations on the powers of the state.
No state shall enter into any treaty, alliance, or confederation, coin money, emit bills of credit, make anything but gold and silver coin a tender in payment of debts, pass any bill of attainder, ex post facto law, or law impairing the obligation of contracts, or grant any title of nobility.
No state shall, without the consent of the Congress, lay any imposts or duties on imports or exports, except what may be absolutely necessary for executing its inspection laws.
No state shall, without the consent of Congress, lay any duty of tonnage, keep troops or ships of war in time of peace, enter into any agreement or compact with another state, or with a foreign power, or engage in war, unless actually invaded or in such imminent danger as will not admit of delay.
Article 2 provides for the executive branch of the government. The executive power shall be vested in a president of the United States of America. He shall hold his office during the term of 4 years, together with the vice president, chosen for the same term. Each state shall appoint a number of electors, equal to the whole number of senators and representatives to which the state may be entitled in the Congress. The Congress may determine the time of choosing the electors and the day on which they shall give their votes, which day shall be the same throughout the United States. No person except a natural-born citizen shall be eligible to the office of president. Neither shall any person be eligible to that office who shall not have attained to the age of 35 years and been 14 years a resident within the United States. In case of the removal of the president from office or of his death, resignation, or inability to discharge the powers and duties of the said office, the same shall devolve on the vice president. And the Congress may by law provide for the case of removal, death, resignation, or inability, both of the President and Vice President. The President shall, at stated times, receive for his services a compensation, which shall neither be increased nor diminished during the period for which he shall have been elected. And he shall not receive within that period any other emolument from the United States or any of them. Before he enter on the execution of his office, he shall take the following oath or affirmation.
I do solemnly swear that I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States and will, to the best of my ability, preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States.
The President shall be Commander-in-Chief of the Army and Navy of the United States and of the militia of the several states when called into the actual service of the United States. He may require the opinion in writing of the principal officer in each of the executive departments upon any subject relating to the duties of their respective offices. And he shall have power to grant reprieves and pardons for offenses against the United States, except in cases of impeachment. He shall have power by and with the advice and consent of the Senate to make treaties, provided 2/3 of the senators present concur. And he shall nominate, and by and with the advice and consent of the Senate, shall appoint ambassadors, other public ministers and consuls, judges of the Supreme Court, and all other officers of the United States, whose appointments are not herein otherwise provided for, and which shall be established by law. But the Congress may by law vest the appointment of such inferior officers as they think proper in the President alone, in the courts of law, or in the heads of departments. The President shall have power to fill all vacancies that may happen during the recess of the Senate by granting commissions which shall expire at the end of their next session. He shall from time to time give to the Congress information of the State of the Union and recommend to their consideration such measures as he shall judge necessary and expedient. He may, on extraordinary occasions, convene both houses or either of them. He shall receive ambassadors and other public ministers. He shall take care that the laws be faithfully executed and shall commission all the officers of the United States. The President, Vice President, and all civil officers of the United States shall be removed from office on impeachment for and conviction of treason, bribery, or other high crimes and misdemeanors.
Article 3 provides for the judicial branch of the government.
The judicial power of the United States shall be vested in one Supreme Court, and in such inferior courts as the Congress may from time to time ordain and establish.
The judges, both of the Supreme and Inferior Courts, shall hold their offices during good behavior, and shall at stated times receive for their services a compensation which shall not be diminished during their continuance in office.
The judicial power shall extend to all cases in law and equity arising under this Constitution, the laws of the United States, and treaties made or which shall be made under their authority.
To all cases affecting ambassadors, other public ministers and consuls, to all cases of admiralty and maritime jurisdiction, to controversies to which the United States shall be a party,
to controversies between two or more states, between a state and citizens of another state, between citizens of different states,
between citizens of the same state claiming lands under grants of different states, and between a state or the citizens thereof and foreign states, citizens or subjects.
In all cases affecting ambassadors, other public ministers and consuls, and those in which a state shall be a party, the Supreme Court shall have original jurisdiction.
In all the other cases before mentioned, the Supreme Court shall have appellate jurisdiction, both as to law and fact, with such exceptions and under such regulations as the Congress shall make.
The trial of all crimes, except in cases of impeachment, shall be by jury, and such trial shall be held in the state where the said crime shall have been committed. But when not committed within any state, the trial shall be at such place or places as the Congress may by law have directed.
Treason against the United States shall consist only in levying war against them or in adhering to their enemies, giving them aid and comfort.
No person shall be convicted of treason unless on the testimony of two witnesses to the same overt act.